This is Back to Back.
Yo, what's up, Back to Backers? This is Willie Joy. Welcome to the show. This is Back to Back. This is my podcast, and this is the 3-year anniversary of the show. Holy shit. I cannot believe we are at 3 years. My manager, my business partner, all of us are in disbelief that we have made it this far. It doesn't seem that long ago that I started doing this show, not having any idea what I'm doing. Now I maybe have 5% of an idea of what I'm doing. Still pretty rough. But look, I could not have made it this far without you, the listener, without the support of this amazing community. So I just want to say thank you. I love you guys out there. I love everybody out there supporting us, helping us grow over the last 3 years. And I'm very excited to bring you this episode. It was a long time coming. I've got Steve Aoki on the show. One of the biggest names in DJing, in dance music, in just kind of everything, culture, I don't know. I don't think I really have to give him much of an intro. You know Steve Aoki. He's got a brand new album out right now called Neon Future 4, part of his ongoing Neon Future series of albums. We talk about kind of the concept behind that in the conversation you're about to hear. And beyond that, I mean, he's a man of many hats. 2-time Grammy-nominated DJ, producer, he's an entrepreneur, he's a philanthropist, he's got a Netflix documentary out called I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, and all of these points, if anything's catching your ear, just keep listening because we get into all of it. Oh, and did I mention, we've got video now too. I'm realizing not everybody got the memo. We're up on YouTube, the videos of each episode, man. So if you're the kind of person who needs a little visual stimulation, you can go stare at our beautiful faces while we have this chat. The link for that is going to be all over my social media. So just find me there and I will connect you. And by the way, if you're tuning in for the first time, welcome. It's great to have you here. Look, I've been doing this for 3 years now. I've been doing this every single week. I've talked to a lot of different DJs, producers, musicians, managers, everybody. So do yourself a favor, scroll back in the feed of this show a little bit. I bet I have talked to some of your favorite artists along the way. Join us in the Discord as well. If you like what we're doing over here, I want you to come join our little community. There's a link in the description of this episode where you can come join the Discord, come chat with me. I'm in there every single day, literally, talking with people, talking about our lives, what's going on, talking about the music we're making, talking about the music we're listening to, posting up memes, all of that shit. And if you're a music producer, there's a section for you as well where you can post up your music, get feedback, connect with other like-minded producers. Look, we got it all, man. The Discord is great. You gotta come hang out with us. The link for that is in the description. There's also a link where you can go keep up with Steve Aoki, everything he's doing. And, you know, look, if you even want to keep up with little old me, the link for that in the description, baby. My email is backtobackpod@gmail.com if you want to reach out directly. Any questions, any comments, any thoughts, any concerns, anything that's going on in your own life you want to talk about, I'm here for you. And please hit me up on social media at Willie Joy or at Back to Back Pod for the show. So look, Steve Aoki, it finally happened. This is one I've been trying to make happen for so long. And, you know, it only took a global pandemic to slow us all down enough for this to be a reality. That should tell you something about the speed at which Steve lives. He's one of the busiest people on earth. So just on a personal note, this really meant a lot to me to reconnect a little bit. And I really don't think I have to say too much more. We go pretty deep on this one. So without further ado, Neon Future 4 is out right now. Go get that. And in the meantime, please enjoy the 3-year anniversary of Back to Back. Thank you to everybody out there listening, watching, and everybody who has supported this show over the years. This is me and Steve Aoki, Back to Back. Let's go. But yeah, man, how are you feeling just in general? I see you are chilling. You're chilling at home. You're chilling. are you at your spot outside of Vegas?
So I'm in my spot in Vegas. Technically it's Vegas. It's like 15 minutes from the Strip. So it's technically outside the Strip. But yeah, it's like, it's just, Vegas is a sprawling desert.
Yeah.
And besides the, you know, besides having my residency here, you can like build your dream house. You could build homes here for a lot cheaper than where I used to live in LA.
Yeah, and you've been out there for a while, right?
Yeah. I moved out here. I bought my house here in 2013 or 2014. I forgot. But it was, over 5 years I've been out here. But yeah, it's great, man. Like I said, LA, I had like a really nice home. My first home, like when I started making money as a DJ in the late 2000s, when I finally like broke my debt and like started making money, and I was like, okay, now I can buy a home. So I bought a nice home. It's 3,500 square feet in Laurel Canyon in the hills. And I was there for like 3 years. And then I realized I'm barely even in California or in LA.
Right.
And I'm like, I signed my residency deal in Vegas. And then I'm like, well, you know, I went out there and I took a look at the homes. I'm like, wow, they're so much cheaper. And you could literally build your dream home. So I started like fantasizing and imagining and started building plans on a home. Like I started drawing up rooms and
right.
I found this home. It's 16,000 square feet.
God damn.
If you can imagine that. So then like when I moved in, every single room in this home has its own personality and it has its own storyline and it has so much detail. And that's what's exciting about this home. Like it's definitely a home that you tour. Like I tour my friends and I go into each room, explain the rooms.
Well, it's got to feel great too, to just be able to sort of actualize a vision on that level, you know?
Yeah.
Because my understanding of you is that, you think in these terms, right? In terms of storylines, in terms of like a bigger vision for something. And it's interesting to think about you applying that even to something like your own house, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's like a lot of things that like, when I was a kid, I dreamed of this situation. So I just made those situations reality. Because instead of, as you get older, you kind of mature and you like those dreams become like more like, oh, that was childish. That was of its time. But some of them are like, you know what? Fuck it. I have to do it now. I got to do it before I'm like, I won't be able to do it. And one of which was building a foam pit room. You know,
I've heard about that.
The trampoline foam pit room, the whole nine yards. Like that room is meant for like a 18-year-old boy.
Well, sure.
Or like a 18-year-old girl that like loves jumping in foam pits. I mean, anyone really. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we can all relate to that. And it's, I mean, just the whole line of work that we're in sort of lends itself to trying to not let go of those childhood ideas, right?
Yeah.
I feel like so much of the whole journey is just not wanting to, I don't know if it's not wanting to grow up, but there is something about just trying to stay connected to that more pure childlike part of yourself, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So to bring it back to you and to the house, you know, I'm sure an amazing house. I've seen some pictures. It sounds great. But now you're stuck there, right?
Yeah.
And you're not on the road because none of us are on the road. And that is got to be a major, major change for someone like you who's famously busy and famously going all over the place. So how has that experience been for you to just be forced to change gears so radically? You know, are you enjoying the downtime? Are you going stir crazy? Where's your head at with it?
I haven't gone stir crazy. I don't know if that's like my nature, you know, like when things like radically shift in my life, I'm not one to go stir crazy.
Do you miss being on the road?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Of course I miss being on the road. There's no doubt about that. But you could live in a glass half full or glass half empty Or, and some may say, either, neither, neither, whatever. Yeah. You know, you could live in like, I heard another term. It's like not glass half full, glass half empty, but overfilling.
Mm.
You have like an outlook on life that's endless.
Yeah, almost like just being grateful that there's something in the glass.
Yeah, exactly. That the glass is always overfilling.
Right.
Because a lot of the time, the perspective is very much a feeling that is infinite. You know, like the feeling of love is infinite. The feeling of energy is infinite. It's not like the idea of what is depleted is only what you say. Once you say it's depleted, then it is depleted.
Right.
It's like that kind of thing. It's like a lot of it's in your head, right? So,
yeah, it's all perspective.
Yeah, if you like look at life more in that regard, then you. I mean, first of all, if you look at life in that regard, you have this feeling you can accomplish anything. And of course, in reality, you can't accomplish everything. But if you have the feeling that you can, you will accomplish a lot more than you could have ever imagined before.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely right.
You know, it's like putting some of that thought process in your head, in your the way you start your day. And then also just like, I'm a realist too, you know, in that regard. So I like go, well, I'm going to put that in my head and whatever I can accomplish, it's better than what I did before. I know I can't accomplish everything, but I'm going to think that I can. So, you know, with that thought process, then like living at home, or whatever happens in your life, whatever situation that throws this drastic turn of events, you know, obviously the generic way to put it is, you know, you take everything with gratitude. You know, you take everything like, you know, like I'm here, I'm alive. I could see, I could hear, I could talk, I could communicate, I could think, I could connect. So what could I do now? You know, that's the thing. Mm-hmm. What could I do at this moment? So that's why I do these live streams. That's why I every day I'm doing some sort of talk with someone, and it's not pulling teeth for me. It's not like, oh no, I have to do this. I'm like, I don't mind. I actually like talking to people. You know, like the Zoom life is the new life.
Zoom life is the new life. I like that.
So it's like, it's okay. I don't mind it. I'm like, of course I think about the shows. I miss it terribly. I do. There's no doubt about it. Like I've been touring 250 shows a year for the past, on average, for the past 15 years.
It's so crazy, man. So when I knew I was coming to talk to you, I was reading some old interviews, like old interviews. And I found this quote of yours from a 2008 interview where whoever you were talking to asked you, where do you see yourself in 5 years?
Holy shit, this is cool.
Which would have been, I guess, what, 2013. And so they said, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And what you said was, touring less, at least I hope I am.
Oh my God. 2008. I was touring pretty hard even back then.
That was probably when it was starting to really ramp up and get really heavy, right?
Yeah. Also, I was a lot cheaper. So it was like any club was booking me, you know what I mean? Like, and I was playing everywhere. I was playing like, I mean, you got to remember, like from my very early beginnings of being in music, not even as a DJ, in music, I was playing in living rooms. I was playing like wherever they would give me space. I played in a kitchen.
Right, because you were in punk bands before DJing, right?
Yeah. We would throw parties in our kitchen. Like we would have Jimmy World play in my kitchen. You know,
amazing.
You know, this is like right before they blew up. I had like all these bands play. I played in the kitchen. I played wherever I could, and you know, if you get a free place to stay, that was what you got paid, and I was excited for that. I was like, yo, we don't sleep in the van tonight.
Right.
Or, you know, so it's like that's like my early beginnings of my music career.
Yeah.
It really proved to me that I loved what I was doing, because it didn't have to be a financial gain. Like I just, all I cared about was having enough sustenance to get by. And, you know, I was a college student. I was in high school at the time. So high school and college student. So it's a different kind of reality than per se, like when you have to make ends meet and you have a family or you have other responsible parties that you have to take care of. But obviously, as I moved to LA and I, you know, brought DJing to my life, or DJing came to my life, and things shifted. Then, you know, when I actually got paid, it was like, this is crazy. You know, getting like 75 moment, right? bucks to play for 60 minutes or 2 hours was like a steal.
Yeah, and you're not splitting it with five other people, right?
Exactly, exactly. You don't split it with like a bunch of people. You get a free bar tab, and you get like, my first gig, I played the whole day at Spaceland. It was like one of the first gigs I got paid.
Wait, what's Spaceland?
Spaceland's a venue in Silver Lake, and I had to bring my own equipment. I remember I was renting for my friend Sam, and it was 75 bucks, but the guy would only pay me 50, so I was losing $25. But I'd play all night,
right? And this was your first DJ gig, like first.
It wasn't my first. It was like the first time I started getting paid.
Yeah, sure.
You know, because I was putting it out there. You know, I was DJing in bars and stuff, and I was opening, and I was happy to get a free drink, you know, like, but definitely not getting paid. And I would open for my friends. They would let me open. I'm like, please, 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 let me play for the first, at least the first, you know, I don't care if anyone's there. And then finally they're like, hey, you like, cause I give them bands. That was my way in. That was the only reason why I got to play Spacelands, cause that place was a place for bands. I had like block party there. Like I was known more as the dim mock guy. I was, because I bring on all these British acts to America,
right.
And the Kills, and like they were one of my bands at the time that was really popular, and not my bands, but the bands on dim mock. And I'm like, please let me DJ. I can bring people in because of the dim mock thing. And it's like, okay, here's 50 bucks. But I'm like, it cost me 75 bucks to rent the equipment. I'm happy just to like do a. Like that was another free gig, but actually, the gig that I got paid was actually I had to pay to play.
Oh sure, yeah.
Well, and then he just didn't want to book me again. I was like, I'm like, yo, can I get paid 75 next time at least? Like he's like, no, man, I was actually considering paying you less because I was like, you know, because I wasn't very good. But
that's so funny.
That's just how it starts, and then you know, obviously, you move up and. I don't even know how we got in this conversation.
Okay, well, two things. I'm going to jump away from this and then jump right back. But the one point I was getting to by saying that quote about where do you see yourself in 5 years, and you said touring less, or at least hopefully, is there any kind of sense of relief right now on your end? Because I think talking to a lot of DJs and a lot of friends of mine, people are almost feeling guilty that they're taking a break right now. And I wonder for somebody like you who has, I mean, you're the busiest guy around, basically. Is there a sense of relief? I assume you're sleeping more.
Yeah, for sure. No, there's like definitely, I'll put it this way. Like, you know, outside of being a DJ, I'm really into health and wellness, whatever you want to call it, nutrition, all that stuff. Primarily because I'm obsessed with the brain.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed with the human brain. And the capacity of what we don't understand about it as well. There's a lot that we don't, and I want to like unlock those mysteries as much as I possibly can while I'm alive. And as more the more of those doors that we can get into, the rooms in our brain that we can get into and start understanding and start utilizing, the more that we can do the things that are science fiction based. You know, like living indefinitely.
And I know you fund a lot of causes looking into those types of things, right?
Yeah. We'll get into that for sure.
Yeah. We'll get there.
So because of that, there's a lot of things that I do in my occupation that directly oppose a lot of the health and longevity and the anti-aging measures and protecting my brain, that I care about, and one of which is sleep. One of which is not getting that sleep. You know, my documentary is called "I'll Sleep When I'm Dead." I have that tattoo, "I'll Sleep When I'm Dead," on the back of my neck. I do tour a lot, and I am obsessed with touring. It's definitely an addiction to be on the road. that hardworking drive. I look at it not necessarily as problem, but as, you know, it's very much like these goals that I've created, and some of which are perpetuated through, you know, the way society has been built. Like this, you know, the way in which I look at life has been built. Like the people I talk to is like, go, we'll get them. And like, if you get it, like, you know, like the big crowd cheer, you know what I mean? Like
right,
that kind
of
like reward. And I'm learning that that's not necessarily the healthiest way to live life.
Right, exactly.
So like, there's a lot of things that like my occupation and like the idea of protecting my brain, protecting you know, my longevity, my life, they like knock at heads at times, you know? So, in this particular time, now I'm doing so many of the things I've always wanted to, that I always said are important,
right,
but didn't practice. I mean, I did practice meditation. I used to meditate every day, twice a day. I used to do transcendental meditation every single day. It was after my vocal cord surgery 6 years ago. I learned that practice and I just kept on with it. And then I learned yoga and I started doing yoga and stuff like that. But like, then that drifted away when you know, more important things came
right
in. Like, you know, just, you know, the different attributes of a busy schedule.
Well, sure, it's just the next goal and the next goal and the next goal, right? Like while you were just talking, I was thinking that, you know, that kind of mindset, in a way, I think it's great because everybody has addictions to something, right? And if we're able to sort of focus the addictive part of our brain on something positive, on something productive, that's generally what you want to do. But I think for people in our line of work, and for people who just have those kinds of brains, the issue can arise when you just get so focused on, okay, I accomplished the goal, I got to get the next one and the next one, that it's really hard to sort of sit in those moments and appreciate the moment itself, the accomplishment itself, without suddenly feeling like you just have to start on the next thing, right?
No, I have to say that the goal is, when you achieve the goal now in my life, it's not as overwhelmingly exciting. You know, what I've realized is that, yes, my goal is to achieve the goal, right? Whatever it might be. You know, whether I'm like reaching out to an artist, I want to do collaboration with them, and I'll do whatever I can to make sure that that collab happens. Whatever I possibly can. And the bigger the feature, the bigger the artist you work with, the harder the problems, the harder the obstacles. But it's like you get there, the feeling getting there, like when you're this close and
yeah,
then like
yeah,
soon it's like, okay, it's out, done. No bureaucratic red tape stopped it. No management stopped it. No label stopped it. The artist didn't change their mind for whatever reason. It's out.
But how long can you enjoy that moment before you're looking for the next moment like that?
Like there is that moment, like that sigh of relief, and it's like a really great feeling. But yes, it's like on to the next one, right? It's like that's how my brain is. But I think I have a high in that.
Right.
And the challenge.
Yeah, it's the chase, right? I think that's a universal theme.
Yeah, it's the chase. It's like the best way to put it. It's like if you just pick up a ball and a bat and you're like, okay, I want to be a professional baseball player. It's like that's not in your sight lines. You need to practice, and then you get in the minor leagues, and then that sight line is realistic at that
point.
So you can't be like, oh, I haven't even started DJing, but I want to be as big as
Steve Aoki
or whatever. Yeah, I want to play at all those places, make the money that he's making and you know, have everyone stream his songs like tomorrow.
Right.
It's like, obviously, you know, but if you do it like in a way where it's realistic, but it's a, you know, real challenge, like a real, like it's a hard one.
Sure. Step by step with realistic goals. I mean, that's the way any of us get anything done, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got to break down those bigger goals.
Yeah. But I think that's the end of the day, that's like also what I'm addicted to is that challenge. And like, cause I have a lot of these different goals in my head. I have a lot of them, a lot of projects. I think a big part of being successful in what you do is that you can apply the same mindset to your own craft, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
But you can also tackle different goals at the same time. You just have to time manage them properly. That's the part of the success. The part of the success is time management, actually.
Yeah, of course, and prioritization, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, especially when you're doing as many things as you are. And all of this makes me wonder, if you look back, if we take it super far back to when you were a kid, were you always this way? Did your brain always kind of work this way? Like, do you have any early memories of, you know, having these kinds of ideals, having a crazy sounding goal when you were super young, you know, before the DJ stuff?
Okay, when I was super young, I felt like I was lazy. I felt I slept a lot. I was very quiet.
Hmm.
But I also was very afraid of speaking.
Why was that?
I would stutter. I would I felt like I would say the wrong things at the wrong times, you know. But I also, you know, I lived in an, okay, so I'm, you know, I'll talk about this too. I lived in Newport Beach. Beautiful place. Beautiful place. California is actually very progressive as a state, right?
Oh, yeah.
But Orange County is very conservative.
Yes.
It's the most conservative hub of America.
Yes.
There's probably other ones, but like, I mean, I know because I grew up in Orange County. You know, I grew up in Newport Beach. At the time, was 96% white.
Wow.
So in a very conservative city or county with a 96% white population, there's going to be a lot of ignorance.
Yeah.
Racial ignorance. So a lot of racism gets perpetuated and supported subliminally or confrontationally. And when it's both, it's like it's heavy. You know, when you have to face it full on, like head on, and you know, kids are like, they have no filter. So like, you're like, when I was a kid, I was facing it head on.
A lot of bullying, that kind of thing.
Yeah, sure. Bullying or just straight up, like, you know, saying all the words you can think of about degrading someone of, you know, of their descent. And then like the subliminal side of things was that it was being overlooked. The parents, the principals, the teachers, they didn't do anything about it. And like back in the 80s, you know, there wasn't this level of like what social media has to offer, this kind of like, okay, the cops aren't going to do anything about it. So at least a social media site or people will come together and say, hey, you can't say that. We can't support these kinds of ideals. Like that just didn't happen back then. So
yeah, there was no national discourse, right? I mean, Rodney King was one of the first, I think, like national events where all of a sudden everyone was seeing this one incident happen at the same time. And, you know, we're talking about 10, 15 years before that.
Right. So like during that time, as I was trying to make friends, I was trying to do the most traditional ways to be accepted or to, you know, be socialized and understand what socializing is, because that's what school is all about. Is
yeah,
you know, it's as much as it's like academic, but I say the academic part of schooling is like less than 30%. You know, a lot of it is like, you know, your emotional intelligence levels and like how you deal with people and social skills and how do you make friends and how do you deal in groups and you know, that applies later on in your life. You know, a hell of a lot, when it's me and my mom at the time, because my older brother and sister, 10 years old, they already went to college. My mom is, you know, broken English. You know, we're living in Newport Beach, and if some shit happened at the schoolyard and like some kid was being outwardly racist, and we got in a fight, like one time that happened, you know, my mom would apologize to the other mom. You know, like, we're so sorry, we won't cause any trouble. Like, that's the Japanese way, you know? Don't keep your head up. Stay down and stay out of sight, because we can't rock the boat, because we're going to, you know, if we rock the boat, if we do anything, they're going to, like, give us a real hard time. Yeah, we have no power here. It doesn't matter what they said to you, what they did to you first. If you strike back, we are going to be in bigger trouble, Stephen. You must not do anything more. And we got to apologize. It's our fault. Sorry about that. So I learned through that process. And as I grew up, it was very difficult for me to, be human. It's very difficult for me to make friends. It was very hard in situations like that. So yes, before all this, before the music, before anything, I was a much different kid. I did start by saying I was lazy and I was sleeping a lot. Yeah, I was sleeping a lot. I didn't want to wake up and go to school. I think every kid is like this.
Was it music that helped you break out of that? Is there something you can look back on and say this is around the time when that started to change for me?
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's the lead-in question right there to why I devoted my whole life to music. Music became my saving grace, if you will, to finding a community, to finding a voice.
And it was punk music at the start, right?
Yeah, because punk music was all about the people that just didn't fit in. Mm. It wasn't a bunch of Asians coming together either, you know? I just didn't have any Asian friends.
Right.
There's just no Asians. Strangely enough, the Asians all lived 15 minutes away from where we lived. So my mom migrated over from the East Coast to California. She missed the mark.
Just a little bit.
No, seriously, in 10, 15 minutes, there's the Japanese community was right there.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So
that's so crazy to think about how much could have been different in your early years.
I think that in the end, if I grew up in Irvine, music might have not meant as much to me. You know, I probably would have found music because it just would have found me in the way that it did. I would have been interested in it, but it was this affected me at such a profound level at such a young age.
Right.
I gave my whole being to it. Like I was saying, in the early days of when I started playing music, I started learning how to play the instruments and started being in bands. And I was like, holy shit, I'm performing in front of people. Even if it's five people, I was still performing, my songs.
Right.
I was writing my lyrics and I was singing from my voice. I was playing guitar from my fingers out of, my friend's amp, things
Finally being allowed to express yourself.
Right? Yeah. And that feeling to do that, no matter how bad the music might have been, was extraordinary. Extraordinary. Mm. I mean, that's the thing. Even when I was in bands back in the day, we never did covers. We'd only write our own songs because we always, because it was such an important thing for me to put my being into something, It was very, very crucial. That was why I was doing it. The music was just, a vessel for me to put my being into something.
That's so interesting that you say that because I feel that's a big part of what makes you, you. Even to this day, I think everything you do, your personality is so imbued into it. And I think that's maybe why people connect to it so strongly, right? Is, some people get known for, oh, he's the best guitar player in the country. Or another person, oh, she has the most amazing singing voice. But for you, I think it's at least this is my perspective. You tell me if you agree.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that it's this force of personality, right? And it's almost more of an attitude.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree in the regard that my skill set isn't technical. My skill set in life is not a technical skill set. It's my skill set in life is based on my passion in whatever it is I'm doing. I put my passion in first and then I start understanding the culture and understanding the world. And first I'm like, oh, wait, what's interesting me? Why am I interested into this particular thing? And then I'll stick my head in and I'm like, oh, wow, this is really something about it. Really making me feel a certain way. Then I start understanding the culture and then I start understanding how I could contribute to that culture.
Sure.
It's like the essential, I go back to being a kid and feeling that same feeling, you know, when I first learned about skateboarding or first learned about, you know, the cultures that accepted me, that, you know, that's another thing too, is acceptance is big for me, you know?
Yeah.
People that accept me for who I am goes miles. So like, you know, and I maintain those loyalty, that loyalty to those friends and the groups that I've been part of that accepted me when you know, I wasn't cool, or yeah, when trends changed and sounds changed, but like, you know, like, I'll still fuck with you because I like you. You know, even though you might not be in the cool squad, I still like, right, fuck with you, you know? So like, that's always been important to me.
Just off the top of your head, who would some of those people be? You know, obviously there's people like DJ AM, who is an incredible legendary figure who's no longer with us. And, you know, I always saw him as kind of the bridge between a bunch of different worlds in the DJ scene. And we'll talk about him in a minute. Are there others as well that come to mind for you that were kind of those people for you?
I mean, there's so many different people, you know, like as far as DJs, you know, like I, one of the first people that comes to mind, one of the most genuine, and really, really moves with his heart first is Skrillex. Is Sonny.
Yeah.
He's a kind of guy that like I think he can only give an authentic relationship to someone, or he just can't.
Right. Yeah. He doesn't do fake relationships. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like a very real conversation, real relationship.
When did you meet him? Do you remember?
Yeah. I met him. He would come into my parties, the Dimmock Tuesdays, CineSpace. And he was a Sonny Moore. He wasn't Skrillex yet. And, this is back probably 06, 07. And he was starting to DJ. I just remember seeing him around, and he was doing the same thing that I do. Like this scene's fucking cool. I want to know more about it. I want to meet the players, you know?
Yeah. Cause he was an outsider too, right?
Right. Yeah. And I remember he's like, yo, here's my music, and we're actually going to release his first EP. We were talking. I met his manager at the time, Tim. He gave me his EP, and I was like blown away. It was just like, it was the My Name is Skrillex EP.
Right.
Before Scary Monsters and Dimmock was going to, we're planning on releasing the EP. That was a plan. There's so many samples that we couldn't clear. So just like, it was like, we couldn't do it, but that's like where we really started talking. Sure. Like I saw him at the parties, but then it's when he came to me. I was like, hey, what's up? You know, I'm Sonny and, you know, I'm doing this thing. And then he, you know, he built the Skrillex legacy that's like one of the most important names of electronic music in the annals of electronic music.
100%.
You know, for the rest of time, he's like, you know, he's like the Beatles of electronic music. So it's just incredible what he's done with his career. And he's always maintained that genuine nature of who he is. And he's always led with his heart first. And
that's a really good way to put it. Yeah, I think that's right. And hearing you talk about, you know, CineSpace Tuesdays and those early nights, and even for you, those early DJ gigs, it makes me think about, you know, coming from the punk background and having that punk attitude. I think people forget now that what you were doing back in the day, like the mid to late 2000s, to the DJ community, it was very punk. And, you know, you were kind of coming in with this different attitude. You weren't DJing the same way as a lot of other DJs. There was this punk attitude to it. And I wonder, how was the reception to you early on from kind of the more like classic DJs, you know, people coming from the other end of the world, the dance music world?
Well, yeah. I mean, of course, there's a lot of major differences, and the walls back then were much more structured and built of steel. Like you couldn't really cross over. Like the purest walls of different genres were like there is no cross jumping. You stay in your lane and that's it. And if you jump around too much, like you're gonna get criticized. You're gonna talk, whatever it is, they ain't gonna like you. And that's gonna be the conversation. Yeah. So I mean, I dealt with a lot of that in my early days of DJing. I think what I've realized is it's not personal. It's a lot of it is the fact that when someone comes up, and as they come up, other DJs are like, I've been doing this for a long time. I have like a thing. Like I don't understand why this person just blasted through, you know, the hemisphere way farther than me or whatever it might be. And not even say like the DJs say that, but like the people that support those DJs.
Sure, of course.
The fans that support those DJs are the first ones to say that. Fuck that guy. Fuck that girl. Fuck why? I don't care. Oh, and then they'll blame them for different things that have no relation. Oh, you know, something that has nothing to do with, oh, he throws cakes. He's the worst.
Right.
All he does is throw cakes. You know, that was actually like in the early 2010s. So I didn't even do that in the 2000s.
And again, it's all perspective, right? Just to make a point on that, like in the late 2000s, early 2010s, throwing a cake at a DJ show, like that was insane. That was a crazy, to me, that's like, that was punk. That came from a punk attitude. And I think just because of where you're at now and your status now, people look at it in a very different way, you know?
There's no doubt that the cake was an evolution of the punk attitude, 100%. Because a lot of the things I was doing at my shows came from, you know, when I used to go to shows. Like the stage diving, the crowd surfing, the high. I mean, I used to do like high jumps.
Oh, I
like
remember.
Balcony jumps off, you know, and I would watch videos and I went to go see Fugazi at the Shrine in like 95 or something or whenever it was. And someone jumped from the balcony at the Shrine.
Ooh, man.
Like you're like, a lot of people would be like, I don't want to be that person. But me, I was like, if I could do that and land and not get hurt, I will do that.
Yeah.
So like, you know, like that's why I brought the raft out and that's why I brought like the inflatable beds out so I can do these really high jumps and like emulate, you know, the legends, like, you know, like Nirvana in the video where he's just climbing and he just falls in the crowd and he's like 20 feet up or you know, even like outside of punk, like what's the singer of Pearl Jam?
Oh, Eddie Vedder.
Like he did some crazy stage dives. I mean, insane.
Yeah.
And man, I mean, he was pretty punk rock as a rock legend, yeah. You know? So, but like, you know, all that stuff is like all based on, you know, the punk world. But in essence, the cake is just another performance bit to all the different things that I loved to watch when I was a fan in the audience of bands doing performance bits, whatever they might be. Because I, you know, in the punk scene, there's like tons of performance artists that are doing really weird stuff on stage.
Yeah.
That, you know, I mean, I'm a big performance art junkie. Like I love watching, you know, that in itself too. And that's like a derivation from the punk world.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think we were seeing up until recently when everyone had to stop touring. I mean, all of the big DJ productions were getting more theatrical. They were, you know, everyone was trying to come up with these ideas. And to me, it all starts from that underground attitude, that punk aesthetic. And I don't know, I'm trying to imagine like you at Ibiza in early days and people just trying to figure out what you were doing. Do you have any memories of those like fish out of water moments?
Oh my God. Okay. So 07, I got my first residency at this club. It was at Manumission parties at Amnesia and at Pasha.
Okay.
So I would fly in once a month and I would play, and they paid me $1,000 all in. So like the whole, like that was great for me because the, like the flight and the, all the expenses would amount to about $1,000. So it was like a free trip to Ibiza. Right. And I remember at Pasha, I was playing and, you know, and like back in 07, I would like go crazy. Like, yeah, I still get pretty wild on stage, but I would just be like in my own zone, just headbanging, hair everywhere, like just no care in the world, even more than I am now.
Right.
And definitely just like imbuing, like, you know, my spirit of being a kid in a band. And whenever I had the opportunity to jump in the crowd, I would be jumping in the crowd. So I was constantly crowd surfing and I remember the next year. So I had like my own little sect. Like they loved it because the shows were pretty live. So people would just be like, okay, I got to see this guy DJ because he's just right. Like, he's going to go crazy. He's going to jump in the crowd or do something. And Pasha, that just didn't happen.
Yeah, the Ibiza scene at the time was so different from what it is
07,
now.
07, right? Pasha, was Bob Sinclair was like a big headliner.
Right.
You know, it was very sexy. It's extremely sexy. Like sexy as you can go, sexy classic house music. And I'm playing boys, like, you know, I was playing like Mastercraft, Boys Noise, Justice, Daft Punk, you know, electro. I was like, I'm going to be like, I want to be the electro guy on the island. I'm going to be coming here every month. And the promoters like accepted that. So actually at the end of the year, I'm going to fast forward this up because I'm explaining to you like where I was the fish out of the water. In my own little world, because they gave me this small little room. It's called a global room. It holds like 400 people, maybe even less. And then the main room was Bob Sinclair. Okay. So if you want to hear all the weird, like that weird music at the time, you come into global room. You want to have that kind of party. And a lot of people are like going in and going out, like, I'm out of here. I don't want to hear this noise. But, and that was okay. I didn't care about them. You know, I was more like in my own world. So at the end of the year, they have this thing called the DJ Awards. And it's, you know, traditionally, it's ranking like, you know, the best set of the season of an Ibiza.
Right.
Or it's not DJ, it was like Ibiza Awards or something like that. I won my first time in Ibiza. I won an award.
Hmm.
I won best set of the season. Like beyond like some of the big names like Tiesto and Armin and whoever else was like dominating, Carl Cox.
Yeah, you were the upstart kid there, right?
Well, I mean, like, for the few people that vote, I guess, they're like, he definitely, Aoki's set was a highlight. It was unique.
Right.
You know, like, I might have got the love then. So in 2008, I got another residency, thanks to my manager, Michael Thien, who just passed away. Really hit heavy about that because he's my best friend.
Sorry to hear that.
But that's another whole thing. But Michael got me the residency at Space. And I was playing with Danny Tenaglia on his night on Thursdays.
Wow, that's a pairing.
Danny Tenaglia, there's like some heavy house heads on that night. I forgot, there's a couple other guys in there. But anyways, I would play that night. So I got paid. I got like, I think I got $5,000 in a gig. It was great. That's a lot of money, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So I got that 2008 and I was playing and it was like, you can't go off board. You can't do what I was doing, when I was doing it. So I remember playing the first nights and people were like, yo, man, like this is not working here. You can't play this kind of stuff here. And the DJs were complaining. All the DJs in the night were complaining to the promoter. Like, why did you book Steve Aoki here? Like, this is like not what we want.
Right.
We don't like him. We don't want him here, you know? And then I was like, fuck. And my manager's like, yo, Michael was like, you gotta change it up or something, man. Like, the DJs like would after I was done, they would be like, please get off the stage, please. Like, I will never forget that moment. I'm like about to trade off and they're just like this. And they're like it was not subliminal. It was blatant. I will never forget his face when he was like, just please stop playing this music.
Wow.
You know, and I don't want to shout him out because I feel rude. But like, anyways, he was not nice to me. And I know he was one of the biggest spokespeople to, and he was very outward about it. The biggest spokespeople to kick me out off the night. And that was pretty much going to be my last night, I remember. And they're like, Michael's like, I'm going to give you one more chance. I begged the promoter to let you try it out again. And Michael was best friends. He's like one of the best friends with Felix the House Cat. And we were all hanging out. Every time we were in Ibiza, we'd hang out. So I came to Felix. I'm like, okay, Felix, I know we don't talk about, you know, we just hang. We don't like, I don't want to ask for any favors here, but please, can you help me? I'm in a bad place. I might get kicked off my residency and I need some music, man. I need some music. So he just blessed me with like his hard drive.
Oh, wow.
Of like, you know, French Kiss and like these techno bangers, all his records, like classics. And so like soon I had like a full playlist of like, you know, 6 to 10 minute tracks, and I wasn't smashing through every minute and a half of Daft Punk and Justice, you know.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, all right, great. So then I just like practiced and studied that playlist and you know, on my Serato at the time. I was using Serato. And I went back in and I just played a techno set and they won him over. I won him over.
Right.
So like they're like, whoa, like Aoki's playing all of these like classic techno records and house records, and then I found like the beauty and the groove and the pocket of techno in that set.
Oh, that's a beautiful moment too, man. Finding that sweet spot between, you know, learning. Again, we talked about this already, exposing yourself to a new culture, figuring out, you know, what you have to say about it, what you have to offer. I think when you find that sweet spot of this is something new, but this is how I can sort of make it my own, that's a really powerful moment.
Yeah, it was great. You know, it's the kind of thing that like, you know, in that place, you know, there's many examples where you're like, fuck everyone, you just do you, yeah, you just do you. Like, who cares what they say? But like, sometimes you can't think like that. Sometimes you got to work with everyone.
Yeah.
I'm not necessarily working with the guys that hate me. I'm not doing it for them.
Right.
I'm not doing it for the guys that hate me. I'll never forget them. Actually, like, their antagonism and their, like, outward negativity was unnecessary. They didn't have to go that far. You know, I understand if things don't fit, if things don't fit. Okay. Like, okay, doesn't fit, but you don't need to like go that far and make me feel like a complete fucking loser. You know, like, you know, it's like there is a time when things don't work and yes, it doesn't fit. I get it. I totally get it. But on the other side, on my side, it's about adapting. And this is where like, you know, this is where the DJ skill set, the DJ mentality comes in, is how do you adapt? That's where DJ Ams was so good, is how he was able to adapt to each room that he played in, because his library and his archive was so broad, and his wisdom and his experience on how to play all these different genres of music. Like, oh, I see some old people coming in. Let me just like make them happy.
Yeah.
I see the young kids losing, like they're not interested anymore. Let me like throw in a couple records that they're going to get, like not an obvious one, but like one that they're going to really get. And then I see other, you know, so it's like about that kind of DJ mentality too.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's about that connection, right? And it's to contrast, you know, the story you just told about AM, that's him just wanting to be open and to get rid of ego and to connect with whoever's in front of him, as opposed to the people you were just talking about in Ibiza, where it's kind of just about their ego, right? And that somebody else is doing it not the way they would do it. And that's just unacceptable, rather than trying to figure out, okay, well, why is he connecting with these people? What can I learn from this, right?
Yeah, the connection is also the secret to a successful career for anyone. The ability to connect, that is one of the secrets. How well you can connect. Because if you are a great connector, you will be successful in your career. And that's my honest opinion.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And so if you look at, you know, we've talked a lot about the early days now and kind of what it felt like and what the attitude was. If you look at what you're doing now, right, do you see yourself and what you're doing now still as punk? Like, how do you see yourself fitting in? Who do you think Steve Aoki is at this point? Like, you just put out a new album, which is Neon Future 4, and you've been putting out this steady stream of music, and obviously you're a well-established, well-known name. How do you see yourself these days?
So going to the punk question, I'm an evolution of what I was, right? Mm. We're talking about like change and adaptation. And it's the punk ethos is always in some attitude, some decision making on every single level of what I do, whether it's music or not. You know, some elements are going to be there. But as I've grown and have learned about many different ways to live life, and I'm constantly a student of life, right? Yeah, I'm constantly like excited to absorb more information. There's things that are going to supersede others. So I'm like, you know, that's like one DNA strand in all my DNA that's like being created to be the 42-year-old Steve Aoki that is today.
You're mutating.
100%. I'm a mutation. And hopefully a positive way. but absolutely. Like, it's important that we don't think of ourselves as a fixed person. We are different. We're physically different 1 second later than we are to now.
Right.
You know, physically, like, we're changing.
Yeah, on a molecular level, right?
So, but we're also mentally changing constantly. So it's the only thing, the only reason why we don't feel like we're mentally changed is because we stop ourselves from mentally changing.
Mm. So would you agree with, you just made me think of this, tell me if you agree, that rather than sort of putting a label on yourself anymore, like before maybe you would have called yourself a punk, and now the label is that there isn't a label?
That's a good way to put it.
Trying to avoid labels?
Yeah, it's true. When you put labels on it, then you start adhering to those labels, you know? So it's, yes, I come from a punk background with the ethos, more hardcore, really. I like punk bands, but I'm more of like a hardcore kid at heart.
Yeah.
For people that don't know the difference, you can just, it's a subset of punk anyways. But yes, it's like, it's better to be free flowing, you know, and have all these different experiences in your journey in life, help you guide you along your pathway on your decisions that you make, the choices that you make. But I think instead of thinking in the past and going in that direction, it's better to think in the future with the DNA that you've combined, right? So you think in the future and you set your goal or a goal that you want to attain. This is what Bruce Lee said. You set a goal that you want to attain and you climb towards that goal. And then by the time you reach that goal, it's a different goal.
Right.
You know, and you just have to accept that it's going to change.
Sure. I mean, if you think about the idea of like climbing up a hill, right? By the time you get up the hill, you'll probably see another hill behind it, right?
Yeah. And also that, like, this goes to show how important the journey is, because the goal does change. I always have the feeling that like anything's possible, you know, and that's why I have a feeling that anything's possible, but I keep my expectations very reasonable, you know, and fair.
Yeah.
So I don't give myself a hard time if I don't reach them.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think, a really healthy attitude. And I think now we're all the way back to where we started, which was talking about, your interest in the brain and your interest in science fiction. And, you know, I was saying, I know you fund a lot of research in these areas, and we're talking about extending life. Your album is called Neon Future. You know, there's all these themes. So whatever this means to you, kind of whatever pops into your head, what about the brain are you thinking about right now? Like, what is driving you? What are you really interested in right now?
Well, if you break it down, the brain is the most phenomenal, like the number one most important phenomena in the universe. Right now, as we know it, we don't know about like alien species or, you know, it's like this intelligence coming from the brain that has allowed us to like expand and like want to learn so much about everything around us. All the things that we don't understand, we want to understand. That's our those are our goals as a species. You know, what happens after we die? What happens in space? You know, are there any species out there? And, you know, and many very important real things like how do we save the planet, you know, because we're a consuming species. And I'm an optimist, generally speaking. So I look at the future more as a utopian, not as a dystopian. Mm. I look at the future in that direction and then try to find safeguards so that as we progress through our technological evolution, because we've surpassed our natural evolution. Natural evolution takes too long now.
Yeah, you're right. It's true.
We are now part of a technological evolution. And with that technology attached to us now, we are already cyborgs because we use technology like Zoom to communicate.
Sure,
we use our phones to help us decide our macros of what to eat, where to go when we drive our cars, whatnot. Soon that's going to be implanted in our bodies and it's not going to be weird.
Yeah, I agree with that.
We're going to be natural cyborgs. We're already cyborgs, not naturally, but we will become natural like beings with technology implanted. You know, we imagine a future where we can live through our technology.
Mm.
That's where I think we'll go, to the point where we do all kinds of things like that. That's a bit exciting. And then like when I go back to the safeguards, as we progress through that evolution, that technological evolution, you know, from a utopian perspective, we have to create the safeguards so that there's no like major problems that happen.
No Terminator
that will decimate
scenario.
Our species, decimate the planet. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So instead of going, oh, the world's going to end, technology's going to kill us, you know, fuck the world. It's like, let's unfuck the world with technology, you know?
There you go. It's just another perspective, man. That's a full circle idea right there.
That's neon future. That's neon future. That is the whole basis of neon future. That is my motto in life is like, you know, I'm a futurist. I think about the future constantly. I'm excited to learn about breakthroughs. That's why I have scientists on the album. And I use music as a platform so I can get into rooms that are of people talking about breakthroughs. I've signed plenty of NDAs, found out so much information about what's about to happen.
Mm.
It's exciting stuff. And I'm lucky that I'm of this kind of influence that people want me to listen. I've been knocking on the door for a long time. And I won't stop knocking on the door. And sometimes they open the door for me. And sometimes they're like, oh, hey, what information is in this room is only value with these people here, but it's going to affect the world in a couple of years. And I'm like, I want to know.
Right.
I have a curiosity. I have like this dying, undying curiosity to know. Like this is my nature now.
Yeah.
So I wake up with that kind of zest and a feeling of like, what else can we figure out? What else
is that part of the drive? Is that part of what keeps you going at such a crazy pace? Just you know, the fact that there's so much left to know and left to learn out there.
Yeah, I guess like when you really boil it down from that bird's eye view, sure, you know, like because yes, the clock is ticking, and if we don't reach to that point where technology will allow our lives to live indefinitely, then yes, we only have a very short amount of time. Like when you really think about it.
Oh, very short.
Like just decades. That's it. It's like, that's it. It's a, you know, crazy. A few decades and that's it. So it's like, fuck, I better fucking learn as much as I can. We can actually get more out of each hour of every day and like really look forward to learning more and more to help each other to like, you know, save our species, to save this planet.
Well, I'll just ask this. This is going to sound like a weird question, but I think we can actually wrap it up with this. on this note, everything we've been talking about, are you afraid of death? Like, what do you look at death as? And do you feel like, are you racing it? Is that part
of it? Yes, I am racing death. I am racing death. I am afraid of death. I mean, that's the thing that I can't control. It's like, I don't know what the hell happens afterwards, you know? You know, like, there's people that absolutely certainly knowing what's going to happen. I'm sure 95% of the population or something, or whatever it is, some crazy amount of the population believes in some sort of religion that gives them that, like, that peace of mind. Like, this is what's going to happen to me, and I'm okay with that.
That there's something after.
Yeah. I mean, that my death can be that. I'm not saying I'm an atheist. I'm not an atheist. I am a person that's like believes that there could be a God, and there also couldn't maybe not be a God. I'm a person that believes that I don't know. That's what my thing is. I just don't know. I mean, I'm not saying no, but the thing is that yes, I am racing death to get to the point where I really truly believe that we will use technology to be able to elongate our lifespan, possibly indefinitely. And then when that happens, there's going to be a conversation, a very common conversation that people are going to have. And they're going to say, can you believe people used to die? That's so bizarre. I can't believe that. It's like us, like when we talk about, like, you know, can you believe people used to use a rotary phone and not have email or have any technology to talk to each other?
Of course. I mean, look at medicine 100 years ago, man.
These conversations are going to happen. And I don't want to be the caveman at the other end, you know, like just being a memory of like, in the 2020s, 2010s, there was a DJ, you know, he's Asian. You know, like, I'd rather like be part of that conversation. You're like, hey, I'm still here, guys.
You're right.
Don't talk like that, you know.
Well, that's beautiful, man. And to wrap all of this up, what I'll say is I think in that race that you're just talking about, which is sort of a serious note to think about, what I think is beautiful is that you're packing all this life into these moments in this race, right? And you're going out there, you're doing more than a lot of people packed into each day. And while you're doing it, you're connecting with all these other humans all across the world and creating these moments in people's lives and having these moments for yourself and still, you know, being a kid, which is what we started off talking about. Still just, you know, connecting to kind of where you started and that pure love, the music that woke you up. All that, man, I just want to say I'm happy you're still doing it. It's great to see you. It's been too long. And thanks for doing this, man.
Yeah, for sure, Willie. It was awesome, man.
I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, brother.
All right. All right, that's the show. Shout out to Steve. Great to talk to you, man. For everybody out there listening, don't forget, Neon Future 4, the new album from Steve Aoki, is out right now. His Netflix documentary, I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, is also available. He's got a book, a memoir out. Look, there's a link in the description of this episode where you can go keep up with everything he's doing because it is a lot. My name is Willie Joy. You can keep up with me as well at Willie Joy or at Back to Back Pod on all social media, or the email address is backtobackpod@gmail.com. That's it for this episode. That officially marks 3 years of Back to Back. Thank you to everybody listening. Thank you to everybody supporting. Don't forget to come join the Discord. Come hang out with me. Talk about this episode we just enjoyed together. Talk about all the older episodes of the show. If you're a music producer, come post your music. If you're a troll, just come post your memes. Everybody's welcome on the Discord, and I'm in there every single day talking to people. The link for that also in the description of this episode. For all my new viewers, for all my new listeners, welcome to the show. We're happy to have you here. So if you like what you just saw, if you like what you just heard, I've been doing this for a minute. I've talked to a lot of musicians on this show, and if you scroll back in the feed of this show, I bet you might just find that I've talked to some of your favorite artists out there. So keep up with us, connect with us, like, comment, subscribe, all of that good shit. And I will be back next week with a brand new episode. We are not slowing down one bit. 3 years of Back to Back is in the can. It feels great to say that. So until next week, take care of yourself, take care of the people around you, and I will talk to you next Tuesday. For Back to Back, this is Willie Joy. Peace.